Hello, and welcome to the Blockchain.com podcast. My name is Nicholas Carey, co-founder and vice chairman of Blockchain.com. So there are over 420 million cryptocurrency users worldwide, and adoption continues to grow. But the story of how we got here since the genesis of the Bitcoin blockchain in 2008 is not straightforward. From the mystery of who is Satoshi Nakamoto, to the rise and fall of early exchanges like Mt. Gox, to the launch of Ethereum, Web3, and cryptocurrency regulation, this is our latest story of segment of the Blockchain.com podcast, where we chronicle the journey by speaking to some of the most influential people in the industry, the space, the pioneers, the advocates, and more. And today, I'm really excited to be joined by Meltem Demirios, head of strategy at CoinShares, a crypto OG, advisor, advocate, investor, and academic, to go back to the very early days and discuss the story of Bitcoin and the blockchain. Meltem, we're so happy to have you. I'd love to ask you the first question here. We always start off with a little tradition, which is, how did you earn your first buck? When did you sort of first learn about money, and what was your relationship to that?
Yeah, that's a great starting question. So I grew up in the Netherlands, and when I was about 10, I moved to the United States. And in Europe, you know, kids don't really run out and earn money. But I noticed that at our school, people would sell Girl Scout cookies or candy bars or books door to door to raise money for all of these different extracurriculars. And so I thought to myself, I want to try selling something door to door. So I went door to door in my neighborhood, did not speak English very well. I'd only lived in the States for about 6 months, and I sold cookies. So I made a little sheet, like a little order form that I made by hand. And there were three choices, peanut butter, chocolate chip, and oatmeal raisin. And I went door to door in my neighborhood, collected money from people, had them order these little cookies, gave some of the money to my mom to buy me supplies, made the cookies, wrapped them up in cellophane, and then delivered them to all my neighbors who had ordered cookies. And so it was a really fun experience, because I'd never really sold something door to door. You're putting yourself out there trying to convince people that they should buy cookies from you, which buying cookies, you know, from a sweet 10-year-old is something I think most neighbors are inclined to do. But that was how I really made my first buck.
I love that story. It's super entrepreneurial. And I think so many people kind of start the relationship off with money in a similar context, whether it's selling cookies or maybe babysitting, you know, mowing the lawn, whatever it is. And so that relationship really does begin at an early age. I think money is such an important topic for people to have conversations about at their dinner tables, but also in boardrooms around the world. What is money? You know, where does it come from? And that's really what we'd like to spend some time exploring today during the podcast. And I think it's important to think about money a little bit like a social construct. It's actually older than written word, and maybe best to be broadly understood as a collection of systems that we use to facilitate the trading of wealth. And so dating back to the time when we were cave people, we used to exchange pearls and feathers, and then we used precious metals in the forms of silver and gold coins, more recently dollar bills and paper money. And so we've always sort of advanced the tool of money using new technologies. And with the invention of Bitcoin and the blockchain, sort of a whole new construct in order to facilitate the trading and exchange of wealth on a global and unified basis. So, you know, maybe thinking a little bit about that, you know, what was sort of your relationship with money growing up? How did you sort of learn about sort of maybe traditional finance and both the tool of money as a something that's useful, but then also some of the problems with the design of money, especially sort of pre-2008?
Sure. Well, I think I had a little bit of a different background than most people in the Bitcoin space. So as I mentioned, I grew up in Europe. And at the time when I was a child in the 90s, the Eurozone did not exist. So there wasn't a single currency. And so we'd go on these vacations as a family. We had this RV and we loved just driving all over. And my dad, when I was quite young, I think 5 or 6, gave me a little purse that had little sections in it. And every time you crossed a border, you'd use a different currency. So you'd go from Holland to Belgium, you'd switch currencies. Belgium to Luxembourg, switch currency. Luxembourg to France, switch currency. And so one of the interesting things, you know, by the time I was 10 years old and moved to the States, I had a huge collection of different currencies from all the places I traveled. And I think most people in the US tend to think of the world as dollar denominated because the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. But a lot of people don't have the privilege of earning money in and spending money in the reserve currency of the world. So that exchange rate and that interchange is something that can add a lot of friction, can add a lot of challenges. The second component that I think is really interesting. So my family is originally from Turkey, and both of my parents are from a small farming community in Turkey. Now, when I was growing up, the village that my parents are from didn't have running water. There was no ATM you could go to get cash. And so it was interesting to see the way my family members, especially my grandma, who we spent a lot of time with, how she stored money. So in Turkey, everyone knows two exchange rates. They know the lira to dollar exchange rate and the lira to gold exchange rate. And here's why. Most people in Turkey do not only store their wealth in lira, they also store their wealth in dollars. That could be in the form of physical cash. And there's a huge market for physical dollars in Turkey. And people store their wealth in gold. So in this village, whenever there were life events, one of my cousins got married, right? Everyone at the wedding gives as a gift this 1 gram gold coin. And it's this little coin. It has little design pressed on it. It comes on a little gold safety pin, sometimes with a red ribbon or an evil eye bead on it. And you pin these gold coins to the bride's dress, right? Or to the groom's sash that he wears. And the reason why is in times of need or when the family has, you know, something that requires money, the idea was they could sell that gold easily, right? And use this gold effectively as a savings account in the absence of having a trusted place to store their wealth. So gold really became a proxy in this place that didn't have any technology and didn't have much connectivity to the modern world. Gold became this de facto savings account for people. So I think those two experiences combined together really showed me that money is really different for people depending on where in the world they live, what monetary regime they're a part of. And that's something most of us really have no control over, right? And I, by the fortune of circumstance, happen to live in the United States. And as someone who lives in the United States and earns money in US dollars and has access to tools and technology in the form of my phone, you know, I'm in New York right now. There's like 30 Chase Bank branches right outside my door. That experience is not similar for everyone around the world. And so when I first saw Bitcoin and started learning about Bitcoin, it made sense to me immediately because I'd seen so much of this as a child growing up and experienced it directly with my own family members who owned liras and watched their wealth basically evaporate as the result of poor fiscal policy, poor monetary policy, and monetary debasement.
Yeah, that is a really cool story. I think the history of Europe's economics are fascinating, and that unified sort of medium of exchange, you could see how that would be useful if you could spend some type of currency in Paris as well as in Athens or in another city in Europe. And there's been some obvious work in the euro to try and facilitate that type of unified economic environment. But it also comes with huge challenges, which is how much of the currency should there be and who's making it, and what is the rate that they're lending that money out to existing financial service providers, and then what kind of obligations do they have to further on customers? And what happens is you get a very exclusionary type of financial services sector, one that can't evenly actually serve everybody at scale. And this is why there are millions of people, even in advanced economies like Europe, that are underserved by their financial services sector. Globally, there are billions of people that are unbanked, period. And so when you combine sort of the sort of failure in delivering basic services to help people send, receive, secure, trade, and exchange basic forms of wealth, but then also talk about the debasement of currency through money printing, through expansive social and fiscal policies, you get into a really sort of concerning dynamic. And this is a big deal right now in 2023 as we see record levels of inflation globally. You talked about your relationship with Turkey, which is fascinating. It's 60%. Monetary debasement in the past 12 months alone. And so getting back to the principles of what sound money, sound currencies really look like is really interesting. And I think gold is a perfect example of something that has some super useful properties, but then also some things about those properties that make it very difficult to use as a medium of exchange. And so it sits in this sort of nice category as a store of value, but not so convenient to maybe buy Starbucks with in New York. So let's talk a little bit more about...
Funny, I mean, sorry, just a little anecdote. When my grandmother passed away, my mom went to clean out the house and kind of, you know, take inventory and One of the things that was so interesting is my mom found all of the different places that my grandmother had stashed gold, and some of it her husband, my grandfather, knew about, but some of it he didn't, because there was no safe and secure way, no trusted way to store that generational wealth that belonged to the family that she intended to pass on to me and her other grandchildren that she intended to use for special occasions. And so it does become really interesting. And I think it's funny because so many people don't appreciate like how challenging it actually is when you don't have access to banking services. And even when you do, there are a lot of places where people don't trust financial institutions because that trust has been repeatedly violated. So, you know, we like to tell these little anecdotes and stories when it comes to crypto, but I can assure you it's very real. Now, does cryptocurrency solve those problems in its current iteration? I think we struggle with some of the very same violations of trust that we've seen in the legacy financial world. So I think it's also very important to recognize that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are not a panacea to some of these problems that exist with money and traditional financial services. And I think we sometimes miss that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So in 2008, we have the global financial crisis, massive bubbles, the collateralized debt obligations that blow up the U.S. housing sector basically bring the U.S. economy down on a wounded knee. Some of the largest financial institutions go insolvent, and we have extraordinary measures taken by the global financial system and the entities and institutions to try and protect it. And in the ashes of that system, the original Bitcoin white paper is published by a pseudonymous author named Satoshi Nakamoto. So what were some of the original themes that you sort of drew from in reading and learning more about Bitcoin in the white paper entitled A Peer-to-Peer Cash Electronic System? What were some of the things that Satoshi was trying to alleviate in looking at the pitfalls of the traditional financial system and working to build something more resilient and less prone to human fraud, greed, and corruption?
Sure. So what's really interesting is the white paper is a whopping 9 pages long. So it's not, you know, a huge document by any means. But the idea, right, that's articulated is this idea, this problem that we've been trying to solve for a long time, which is how do I enable and facilitate peer-to-peer transactions in a secure and trusted way? And I think with the advent of the internet and the growing importance of the internet and this digital connectivity in our lives, how do we do that digitally, right, over trusted medium? And so what actually is more interesting to me than the white paper is actually Satoshi's comments on the early Bitcoin talk forums. And I think it's really interesting. You know, historians may study papal bull, which were papal decrees, you know, in the Renaissance and the Middle Ages. People study Fed announcements, you know, that come from the US Fed. You know, Fed Day is always a big event for me. FOMC is fun. Everyone waits on bated breath to see what Jay Powell is going to say, if the money printer is getting turned on or off. Similarly, I think people are going back in history and looking at Satoshi's comments on these Bitcoin talk forums, which I think revealed much more of the political and social ideology behind the creation of Bitcoin. And so, again, as we kind of look at this body of work taken collectively, and it wasn't just Satoshi, there were a lot of early members of the cryptography community. After all, you know, the Bitcoin white paper was very purposely released on the cryptography Linux server, right? The Cypherpunk's mail server, which didn't have a lot of members. And so there were very deliberate choices made by Satoshi in terms of how they wanted to release the white paper, the community they were targeting, and the types of people who got involved early on that I think resulted in the creation of this really fascinating myth, this narrative around Bitcoin. And again, humans are social creatures. Our history, right, is a collective of stories, this mythos, this lore, these stories we tell. And I think Satoshi did an incredible job weaving together really important elements of what was happening in the world around that time after the GFC and the frustration people felt, but that also targeting really specific community of people who had long been passionate about privacy, around self-sovereignty, and about the ability to use technology as a tool to enable people to have more choice when it came to their personal autonomy. So, you know, a lot of brilliant things were done. I think Bitcoin was a very deliberate, very intentional thing. And the way that Bitcoin was released into the world was incredibly deliberate. I just wonder how long Satoshi sat on that white paper and sort of waited. You know, was the GFC the catalyst? Was this planned and, you know, were they sort of waiting and then this happened and they said, okay, this is the perfect time. But there's so many deliberate choices that went into how and why and where Bitcoin showed up in the world. And it's just fascinating to look at that history.
Yeah, a little tidbit that's you know, sort of in the lore of the launch of the Bitcoin network was in the Genesis block as a reference to the headline in the Times newspaper that says Chancellor on the brink of another bailout. And so he's sort of introducing this idea, well, maybe there's another way, an alternative way to build a financial system for the age of the internet. And so you have to sort of begin the process of thinking about what are the ways that we need you know, a financial system to operate? How do we want it to be accessible by more people across the globe? What kind of features would this new type of financial system need to have? And maybe what are some of the properties of the money itself that we would want to run on this type of network? So let's talk a little bit about that. You know, how does Bitcoin as a currency or financial instrument differ from, say, dollars or maybe gold? And we'll keep it in a pretty simple context in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way I like to think about Bitcoin is sort of this layered architecture. So first and foremost, right, Bitcoin is a protocol. The predominant implementation of Bitcoin is Bitcoin Core, but there are other reference implementations, right? And any good protocol should have multiple reference implementations. But Bitcoin is a protocol. The protocol is code that dictates the rules of the Bitcoin network, what is permissible when it comes to transactions. The monetary supply is hard-coded in, right? The supply inflation schedule is hard-coded in. The way that miners interact with the network and the rewards they receive, all of that is hard-coded into the protocol. And so I think in an age of open protocols, right, we had just seen the explosion of the internet, and the internet was made possible. The interoperability of information and data formats was made possible by these open protocols that codified and created rules around standard formats for things. So if you want to send a video, there's a format for that. If you want to send an email, there's a format for that. And that allows these different clients to operate on one protocol and to use one standard. So the protocol itself is incredibly valuable. The second component is the network. One of the things that's really unique about Bitcoin is Bitcoin tethers this idea of digital money to the world of physics and the laws of thermodynamics through proof of work. Now that sounds very nerdy, but one of the things that makes Bitcoin really unique is you have to expend energy to maintain and secure the Bitcoin network. Now, a lot of people are not fans of spending energy, but one of the realities of the world we live in is that as we become an increasingly technologically advanced society, we do tend to use more energy because technology requires the use of energy, right? You and I are sitting here and we're using devices that consume energy. The connectivity we're reliant on uses energy. The food we eat, the items that we ship to our home, all of these things require energy. So one of the really unique things that I think gives Bitcoin tremendous value and tremendous security as a network is the fact that there is a very physical instantiation of the Bitcoin network that requires a tremendous amount of physical infrastructure. And so this anchoring of digital value to physical infrastructure and thermodynamics in the form of energy expenditure is incredibly important. It also makes Bitcoin incredibly challenging to attack, whether that's by nation state or non-nation state actor who's seeking to exploit the network. Attacking the Bitcoin network is very challenging. Nodes and miners are located all over the world. It's really challenging to find them, even if you have their IP addresses. Shutting down the Bitcoin network, the physical Bitcoin network, is actually next to impossible. It would take a massive coordinated attack to take down even 51% of the network. And then more importantly, from a capital expenditure perspective, the Bitcoin network is supported by billions of dollars of high-performance computing in the form of ASICs that are located in data centers and homes all over the world. And so this physical resilience and this physical instantiation is incredibly important. And then the last component is, right, all of these applications. What's beautiful about Bitcoin is you don't necessarily need to use blockchain.com or another service to interact with the Bitcoin network. You can leverage applications, third-party applications that connect to the Bitcoin network and offer you a simple interface to do so. But what's beautiful about Bitcoin is anyone, anywhere in the world with an internet connection and a computing device can access Bitcoin and interact with Bitcoin. There are tons of open source libraries. There are tons of open source tools you can leverage. And so this beautiful ability to have choice of how you interact with this network, you can do it through a trusted intermediary that simplifies the process and obfuscates some of the complexity, or you can DIY it. And there's so much incredible education out there for people who want to interact with Bitcoin directly. Just makes it so incredibly cool. And I think we're just at the beginning, right? Like we're just beginning to work on upgrades that are going to continue to make Bitcoin easier to use and frankly, more accessible for a wider range of applications. And so while some of us are like, oh my gosh, it's been 13 years. Why isn't, you know, Bitcoin ubiquitous? Why isn't everyone using it? The fact of the matter is, right, like we're still in the infancy of this very novel concept that I think is difficult to grasp because there's so many different layers to it.
You made some really great points, and to summarize just a couple of them and repeat them out loud because it helps me remember them too. So Bitcoin was designed as this open protocol that enables people to share precious information over the internet. And when that transaction is made, it gets recorded in this blockchain or online database, basically, that has a history of every single recorded transaction. And so now you have sort of this global utility that enables anybody anywhere in the world with access to things like the internet to basically send precious information back and forth. And the design of the currency is particularly interesting because it draws on sound money principles. Just like there's a certain amount of gold in the Earth's crust, it's difficult to acquire, requires a lot of energy to extract and refine, but once you get it, it has some properties that make it super useful. Gold is fungible. One piece is exactly the same as the next. It's durable. It's very difficult to counterfeit. You can divide and recombine it. So it's a very good store of value. Now, because gold is heavy and difficult to secure, it's not great as a medium of exchange. Bitcoin sort of solves for both of these, although although arguably not perfectly, which is one of the things that's constantly being iterated on. But I think it's important that it draws on some of these very ancient source of value that we're all very familiar with in the form of precious metals, and then using those lessons to build digital version of those for the future of how we transact with each other. So I love all those explanations, and especially around the – yeah, go ahead.
Really important component that most people don't appreciate. Bitcoin isn't just a money protocol. It is the first secure computing protocol that we've ever had where you can buy capacity on the network. And I think this relationship with transaction fees in the form of Bitcoin, right? You pay for transaction fees using Bitcoin. And the fact that you have this global supercomputer, right, that is powered by Bitcoin is incredibly powerful. We've never before in the history of the world had a secure computing medium where block space or capacity on that medium is priced in a digital currency. And so I think what we're seeing is the early innings, and I come from the world of commodities, oil and gas, and like, you know, physical things. We're seeing the emergence of a new world where for the first time we can actually create digital commodities that will form the backbone of this new digital economy that we're trying to replicate through these traditional trusted intermediaries, but you simply can't. So I think it's much more compelling than just money. It's for the first time we have a global secure computing medium. It happens to be really useful for financial computing, but there are a host of other applications that are now possible. We for the first time have true fidelity of information, which is something we've never had before in human history, because we've always relied on someone to translate it, to write it, to archive it, right? And history has been rewritten many times. Yep. But Bitcoin, for the first time, gives us fidelity of information because of this nature of the blockchain.
That's an awesome point. Yeah, I think it puts users firmly in control of their funds. It puts the participants of the network firmly in control of its development long term. You have a really beautiful alignment of incentives and all of that. It has network effect money. And that's, when you think about how you would potentially design a currency for the age of the internet, you would want it to have many of these properties. And so I think talking a little bit about, what's happened over the past 10 years, let's like peer into the future a little bit. You know, I think 14 years ago, the Bitcoin network went live, and this new technology that was designed to help humans exchange value and protect wealth was sort of introduced to the world. At the time, it was absolutely mocked. It was ridiculed. The media made fun of it. It was vilified by politicians, academics. But this small band of volunteers, privacy advocates, developers, cryptographers, security experts, cypherpunks, and even advocates of things like human rights and others, really built on the early foundations to deliver on something that is now used by hundreds of millions of people around the world. And actually, Bitcoin, with a market cap even today in 2023 of roughly $480 billion at this time, is still more valuable than any of the largest banks in the world. And that is how fast this transition has already begun. And it really is, I think, in the early innings still, when you think about the total scope of economic activity in the world and how there are still billions of economic participants that are still excluded from the ability to do basic things like sending, receiving, securing, trading, and exchanging digital forms of wealth. Now, there's a medium that allows them to do that today, and we're there are participants worldwide building the tools to help people access that network. But let's peer into the future a little bit. What are the things that you're excited about kind of longer term? You know, what are the generational shifts you could see maybe over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years peering further into the future?
Sure. I think one of the big shifts we're seeing, and I'm going to go a little bit esoteric because I feel like, you know, this is the right
word.
Sorry, I try to hide it. I'm not very good at it. I think one of the things that's really exciting, so we live in the age of the nation state, right? And really this construct of, you know, we had the age of the tribe, then we had the age of the empire. Now we live in the age of the nation state. And I think that's starting to evolve. We're seeing power shift away from institutions more to influencers, right? And individuals. If we just look, for example, what's happened with media and how we uncover information, how new trends and new narratives are created, they're no longer really created by institutions and nation states. They're created by idiots like me and many others on the internet, right, who have these radically different visions for the future. And I think that's really interesting. And I think the next question is, like, what is the evolution beyond the nation state? The nation state has historically had sovereignty and the ability to print and manage money. And that has been a massive component of what drives the power and wealth of these nation states. But that's now starting to shift. There are corporations who command more wealth than most of the G20, right? There are multi-trillion dollar companies. The construct has never existed before. And I think what's really fascinating about Bitcoin and other crypto communities online is we're seeing groups of individuals and these loose internet communities creating their own wealth, right? So Bitcoin is a massive economy. Last year, the Bitcoin economy processed close to $20 trillion in transactions. That's more than all of the card processing networks combined. So crypto economies are becoming as large as nation states. They're becoming as large as corporations. If you take the collective users of the Bitcoin network, right, the population, quote unquote, of people who identify as denizens of Bitcoin Nation, right, is absolutely enormous. And so I think this idea of these online communities of people who loosely share the same set of values, same set of principles, and these people now being imbued with real financial capital, having tremendous social capital and influence on the internet, and also starting to command political power, right? Because this is becoming a voting issue, as we're seeing in the current election cycle. There's a lot of talk about cryptocurrencies. People are looking at how politicians, you know, are positioning around crypto. I think what's really interesting is, like, we see the emergence, like, out of this primordial ooze weirdness that is Bitcoin space, we do start to see the emergence of a group of individuals who are self-organizing in new ways. And the internet is the medium through which we do it. But I think of Bitcoin almost as a digital nation state. We have our own currency. We have our own monetary policy. We have, you know, some social beliefs that I think Satoshi articulated really well in the white paper, as well as in subsequent comments on the Bitcoin Talk Forum. But there is this, like, really cool collective that's being created. And the question is, what are we now going to do with that influence and that power? We're starting to see, you know, these different schisms forming. But I think there is this unified push that's really exciting. And so to me, that's one of the things that's really exciting about the future. It's not just, like, what we can enable from a technological perspective. I think democratization of money and financial inclusion is also really exciting. And to me there, it's less about Bitcoin being a panacea to all these problems, but it's about giving people choices that they've never had before, right? I've never really had the choice to hold anything other than dollars, but now I do. And I think choice is incredibly powerful. But I think the really interesting thing is, like, how will this become a tool for how we organize ourselves as humans? And how will this become a tool to create a more optimistic future or vision for the future for human society? And I think it's particularly important in this day and age when so many people feel a real crisis of meaning, right? People really struggle with meaning in a way that I don't think we've really felt in prior decades. And so we have all of these people who are searching for meaning, and they're finding it in these fringe online communities around Bitcoin. And I think that is really potent and really powerful. And if I were a politician, I'd be extremely concerned about that, which is is why I think you see so much backlash and criticism of Bitcoin still today in the mainstream media and, you know, with traditional financial institutions, because the alternative vision for the future that we are trying to create is incredibly scary to institutions and people who have power today.
Right. And I think if you look back at those original founding principles, though, it's scary because those that control and rent seek and have business models that are all about walled gardens and financial surveillance stand to lose a lot in an alternative world where the principles of accessibility, open source, decentralization, and transparency are integrated directly into the monetary and protocol policy of the financial system that is being built directly natively into the internet. And so I think there's probably, you know, space between these worlds. And you see that where the large traditional financial service providers are starting to tinker with this stuff or offering, you know, new finance vehicles to their clients that also include crypto and other digital assets in a variety of, you know, exotic bundles. But, you know, in the long run, I do see it sort of all merging together in some way. And I do think it is very unlikely that the technological advancement will be slowed. And if anything, it's we're already witnessing just the speed at which the open collaboration across borders with talent, you know, volunteering its time to improve not just Bitcoin, but many of the cryptocurrency projects globally. I see that as a hugely positive thing for human evolution and for human progress. And so getting back to like, what is the whole point of all this? You know, when we think about, you know, what is money again? Well, you talked about, you know, it being this tool that we use to exchange and trade wealth over time. And in the age of the internet, we need better tools. And if we look at the colossal collapses of confidence due to central banking, whether that's in Turkey or now globally due to the extraordinary fiscal policy response post 2008 through quantitative easing and this incredible increase in the supply of dollars, and now economists all around the world going, we don't know why there's inflation. Well, of course we know why there's inflation. They printed a ton of money out of thin air. So when you create a lot more of something, you also decrease.
Isn't it shocking how that happens? Who would have thought? But I want to quickly make a caveat here, Nick, which is rent seeking is not unique to traditional financial institutions. There's also rent seeking in the crypto space, because at the end of the day, you run a business, I run a business, right? And to run a business, you need revenues. And so I think really this isn't necessarily about lowering costs quite yet, because I do think a lot of crypto services are actually more expensive than their traditional finance counterparts sometimes. What this is really about is choice and transparency to me. And I think choice, again, is incredibly powerful. But it's also important to recognize that people are in very different places in their crypto journey. Some people, you know, have been in the space for a while, or they feel very comfortable with self-custody. And so they're way out here, you know, on the cypherpunk side. But there are a lot of people. I think of my dad. My dad is still convinced that I'm going to go to jail because I work in crypto. My dad does not want to manage his private keys. My dad wants to log into a nice interface or trade crypto in his bank account or his brokerage account. So we do it. CoinShares is perfect for him because he can just type in a ticker and trade cryptocurrencies the way he trades stocks. And there's this huge and very wide spectrum. But I think what's really cool about it, again, is there's a lot of choice, and there's a lot more choice than we've ever had before. And I think that's really the powerful thing, is this choice. But I also, you know, want to be realistic. At the end of the day, people need to create products and services that allow people to interact with Bitcoin and make it useful in a variety of applications. So I don't think rent seeking is a bad thing. At the end of the day, right, the corporate form has existed for a long time and will likely exist for a long time. And so, you know, we also need the ability to run these companies and to make money. So I don't want to be too pessimistic.
Yeah, I think it's okay to make money. It's also okay to be transparent about how you do that, where the fees are, et cetera. And there's a huge number of service providers out there. But I do think it's important to remind viewers and listeners that are sort of new to crypto, is so important to do your homework. You should work with firms that are established. You should work with firms that you know, have proper governance, and talk about who their teams are and what contributions they've made. I think it makes
or a difference. Or maybe firms that are publicly listed and publish their financials.
Yeah, like CoinShares.
And then I think also it's really important to interrogate the fees that you're paying. A lot of times those fees are bundled into the interchange rate. But there are a lot of great service providers that offer great services at very reasonable cost. And again, this choice, this ease of use, the flexibility, the transparency is incredibly powerful.
Yep. Great. Well, let's leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining us today. I think, you know, it's if you've been following the crypto space or if you're new to it, Bitcoin and the crypto market tend to be volatile. And I think that should be relatively expected. These networks are establishing themselves as alternative financial systems natively designed for the internet. And I think the long-term prize here is huge. You're deploying potentially a globally scaled financial utility, a property rights system for the internet to enable the near frictionless exchange of value and precious information. These things are stored on immutable ledgers without centralized entities. This is a monumental technological, economic, and social improvement. To many people who've been in the sector for a long time, we see it as nearly as disruptive as potentially the printing press or the telephone or even the advent of nuclear power. So it should be seen as something that is going to take time, though. There's a lot of work to do to, from my perspective, deliver on these promises, especially the philosophical ones. And time and time again, we learn why it's so important to do those things right. And so, check out coinshares.com. They're also available on publicly listed exchange. Thank you so much, Meltem. And if you learned anything you wanted to dig into, please visit blockchain.com or coinshares.com.
And also, don't trust, verify. Very important principle. And if there's one message we leave you with, it's the beauty of a public ledger is you don't need to trust, you can verify. If you choose to trust, you can also do that. But that's the beauty of choice.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the blockchain.com podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, please like and subscribe to the show. And if your friends and family are embarking on their crypto journey, why not share this episode with them? If you haven't already, visit blockchain.com to sign up for a free crypto wallet today. We've been around since 2011, and we're the world's most popular way to buy, sell, and trade crypto. See you next time.